The headlines, reports come out of Ukraine's capital say gunfire has erupted near the government district there on the second day of the military conflict with Russia. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov says his country is seeking to ensure demilitarization of the Ukrainian government but has no plans to occupy Ukraine. France says it's speeding up the deployment of its troops in Romania a day after the U.S. announced the dispatch of thousands of forces to Germany. Hello and welcome everybody here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. Our top story for this half hour, the conflict between Russia and Ukraine enters its second day. Moscow now says its forces have destroyed 118 Ukrainian military infrastructure sites. The Russian Defense Ministry has denied allegations it launched missile attacks on Ukraine's capital, Kiev. The Ukrainian government says Russia has bombed 33 civilian sites over the past day. Clashes have been reported just outside Kiev. Inside the city, gunfire has been heard near the government district. Kiev's municipal authorities have urged people to stay indoors as Russian forces approach the city. Since the early hours of Friday, blasts have been heard in other major Ukrainian cities too. The president says the world has left his country alone.
This morning, we are alone in defending our country, just like yesterday. The most powerful forces in the world watch from afar. Have yesterday's sanctions persuaded Russia? We see in our skies and feel on the ground that they are not enough.
Zelensky has earlier said he's not afraid of talking about neutrality as his request for joining NATO has remained unanswered. The Ukrainian president says a Western military alliance is afraid of accepting his country. Over 100 Ukrainians have been killed since Russia began its attack. Thursday, Kiev says it has killed dozens of Russian and pro-Russian troops. Moscow, meanwhile, says it controls Ukraine's skies. Earlier, we were joined by our correspondent in Moscow, Marina Kortunova, for the latest on Russia's military operation in Ukraine. She says the government made the decision after all its efforts for resolving the crisis through dialogue were ignored by the West and the U.S.
Our population is divided. Some people, they simply kept blind and just decided to wake up in one day, and they didn't care to, that was a torment in Ukraine for 8 years, and some, of course, support, but they support presidential decision. And this is a huge informational job to explain everyone, to put in people's consciousness what's the real situation here in Russia. And for 8 years, Russia has been begging the international community to put pressure on Kyiv in order to start a dialogue between the Kyiv regime and Donetsk and Lugansk. Every negotiation between Russia and the British, Americans, French, Germans, Italians, Spaniards, and everyone else dragged on for hours with materials, facts, photos, photographs on the hand. And the same true is with international organizations, the OSCE, the UN. They are overflowing. They have been overflowing with materials and information provided by Russia every day, but they were not tormented by consciousness. And the consciousness doesn't wake up in one day. In Europe, in the United States, it's gone.
Well, the Russian foreign minister says his country is seeking to ensure demilitarization of the Ukrainian government and has no plan to occupy Ukraine. Sergei Lavrov says Russia wants the independence of the Ukrainian people. He added Moscow doesn't see the possibility to recognize the current government in Kiev. The top Russian diplomat also said his country is open to negotiations if Ukrainian forces lay down their arms. Western countries are strongly critical of the Russian military operation in Ukraine and impose sanctions in response. Russia says it will remain part of the global economy despite those measures. Well, we do have breaking news reactions coming in with regards to the conflict in Ukraine. President Xi of China stresses that Beijing is ready for close coordination and mutual support for Russia at the United Nations. We're going to keep a close eye on those developments as well. Staying with the conflict between Russia and Ukraine, the European Union is planning to further toughen sanctions on Moscow. The French finance minister says the EU wants to cut all links between Russia and the global financial system. Bruno Le Maire says the European Union wants to isolate Russia financially. British Defense Secretary Ben Wallace also says his country is pushing its allies to cut off Russia from the SWIFT global interbank payment system. Meanwhile, an EU official has said the bloc's member states have agreed to freeze the European assets of Russian President Vladimir Putin and Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. Earlier, the EU Commission president touched upon the sanctions that Brussels has so far imposed on Moscow.
We're now targeting 70% of the Russian banking market, but also key state-owned companies, including the field of defense. And these sanctions will increase Russia's borrowing costs, raise inflation, and gradually erode Russia's industrial base.
The United States has also announced a wave of new sanctions on Moscow targeting several major Russian banks. Meanwhile, French President Emmanuel Macron says his country will accelerate troop deployment to Romania to bolster NATO forces in Eastern Europe. This comes a day after the United States announced the dispatch of thousands of American forces to Germany. Rami Mazari is joining us now from the French capital, Paris. Ramin, let's first of all go over the French response to the conflict between Russia and Ukraine. The French president has said that his country will accelerate troop deployment to bolster NATO forces in Eastern Europe. Will that help the situation right now?
Well, first of all, let me just say that the clip you played from our colleague in Moscow was really just great. We just have to do so much demystification about what's been going on since 2014. And Vladimir Putin, you know, he said it very clearly. You mentioned that Lavrov talked about the demilitarization. Putin also talked about the denazification in the Ukraine. This is something that they never, ever talk about in the West. But it's very simple to understand. Just as the West supplies far-right fundamentalists in Syria, like al-Nusra, or in Libya, so they have done the same thing in the Ukraine. And now these chickens are coming home to roost. You asked about France, they are dispatching some troops. It's really very vague, but one thing that we know for sure is that no one here in Europe is going to be fighting for the Ukraine. I mean, that's just not something that is seriously going to happen. You mentioned talking about sanctions, and it's just really sort of amazing how Western leaders brag about sanctions that are going to impact the average Russian person. That it's aiming to raise inflation. It's aiming to make their economy more unstable, and they are bragging about it. Of course, sanctions are a act of war. Regarding cutting off Russia from the SWIFT global interbank system, the German chancellor said that that's not going to happen. So nobody right now, even though France's foreign minister said that, he's probably just doing what France does all the time, which is just play good cop to the bad cop of the UK and the United States. Remember that the EU requires totally unanimous decisions, so to cut them off from SWIFT is something that seems very, very unlikely. We have to remember that Russia is prepared for what they've done. They are prepared for a financial war. Guess who isn't? The Eurozone. The Eurozone remains the weak link in the global economy, and their banking system cannot handle this type of a stress. So European leaders know that they have been walking on financial eggshells for a decade, and that anything that would send their interest rates up, that would separate bond yields from places like Italy with Germany, that could cause absolutely catastrophic consequences for the euro. So that's not really going to happen. Last two main things, they are talking about sanctioning Putin and Lavrov, but not from traveling. So they will be allowed to engage in diplomatic missions. And Putin has said that they are ready to send a Russian delegation to Minsk in order to find a peaceful negotiation, something that has been going on for almost a decade with these far-right groups that are always supported by the West in order to destabilize other countries.
And what about the overall role of Europe in retrospect? Could it, Europe have acted differently to de-escalate the situation?
Well, I mean, if we're talking about in the last 2 months, absolutely. If we're talking about in the past 10 years, absolutely. The main problem is that just like with the JCPOA and Iran, nobody is holding Ukraine and their Western backers to the Minsk Accords. Once again, they have made these peace agreements, and then they don't follow them at all. We have to remember who we are, who the West is really led by, the United States, and who is the Undersecretary of State, Victoria Nuland. She famously said, you know, F the EU. These are the, you know, how can Ukraine and Russia make peace when these are the types of people who are running the show here? So Europe, for them, the sort of main thing about Europe is that this is going to hurt them much more than it hurts the U.S. Will Europe start to look out for their own interests, or will they continue to be a puppet for people like Biden, Biden's son who worked in Ukraine, and Victoria Nuland?
All right, thanks a lot, Zoran Mazzotti, joining us from the French capital, Paris. Our correspondent Chris Denhon says the West is issuing sanctions on Moscow because it does not want a direct military confrontation with Russia over its conflict with Ukraine.
They are strengthening the current defensive or offensive military forces in the NATO countries. There is nobody speaks about ground. Sending ground troops to Ukraine. That's a very important point. So militarily seen, the European Union countries try to increase their military presence in the current NATO states. Another important economic fact is that the gas pipeline, the Nord Stream 2, is being blocked by Germany. It's not operating, which is an important fact for Russia. Now, concerning economic sanctions, I think Russia could compensate this by closing the relations with China, because everybody knows that China has an important cache of money. So this will certainly affect the Russian economy, but it's important to see that there is no discussion about sending ground troops to Ukraine. So an open war, I think nobody is wanting an open war confrontation with Russia. So this is, at this moment, important political condemnations and economic sanctions.
Elsewhere, a jury in the U.S. state of Minnesota says three former police officers involved in the 2020 killing of black man George Floyd are found guilty of violating his civil rights.
Today, former officers Tao, King, and Lane stand convicted by a jury of their peers for willfully violating Mr. Floyd's civil rights, the same rights guaranteed to all of us by the United States Constitution. These officers had a moral responsibility, a legal obligation, and a duty to intervene. And by failing to do so, they committed a crime.
Based on U.S. legislation, all law enforcement officers must provide medical aid to those in their custody. Now in Floyd's case, the three former cops are convicted of showing deliberate indifference to his medical needs. Two were also convicted of failing to stop the use of, quote, unreasonable force against the African-American man. The trio will now remain free on bail pending their sentencing hearing, but the new conviction can affect the severity of their sentence. That has raised hopes for serving justice.
How y'all doing? I'm Philonis Floyd, brother of George Floyd, and I have my nephew with me, Brandon Williams, who George raised like a son. Today is a good day for us, that this is the first time that I ever seen something like this. Did four white officers were convicted of killing an African-American man.
The fourth former officer involved in Floyd's killing was Derek Chauvin. Last year, he was convicted of murder and is now serving 22 years in prison. Chauvin knelt on Floyd's neck for nearly 10 minutes before he died. The incident happened in May 2020 in the city of Minneapolis. It sparked months of protests, both inside and outside the U.S. against police brutality, and raised calls for justice for African-Americans. Intensive talks between Iran and the P4+1 are still ongoing as parties to the negotiations try to find a way to hammer out a deal. In the next report, We'll see how the dialogue seems to have reached a make-or-break point after significant progress.
Vienna's Palais Cobourg Hotel, the venue of marathon talks between Iran and the P4+1 group. It has once again become the center of a lot of attention, as parties involved in the tough negotiations have signaled significant progress despite the complexity of some issues. The eighth round, which began on December 27th, has now become one of the longest rounds of talks between Iran and the P4+1, namely Russia, China, Britain, France, and Germany. Iran and the P4+1 are completing a draft text of an agreement to revive the 2015 deal. Most of the delegations acknowledge that the talks have reached a critical stage. The diplomacy seems to be approaching a make-or-break moment. Iran's lead negotiator says being near the finish line does not guarantee crossing it. Ali Bagheri-Kani says it requires extra caution, much perseverance, additional creativity, and a balanced approach to take the last step. The Iranian diplomat points out that to finish the job, there are certain decisions that the Western parties to the negotiations need to take.
Thus far, the West has been reluctant to make any sweeping political decisions that are necessary to bring the United States back into the plan. Iran isn't just going to forget the very many U.S. and Western provocations since the United States left the plan in 2018, and they understand that there are many political camps competing at once for power. The West needs to make sweeping political decisions that will definitively outline the future of U.S. involvement in the plan.
Iran says its initiatives pave the way for the progress in the negotiations and that a good deal is within reach in the Austrian capital. Tehran believes that the ball is now in the West's court, and if it shows serious determination, a good deal can emerge.
Some Western parties to the talks between Iran and the P4+1 have warned that time is running out fast. They've tried to impose deadlines for the talks, but the Iranian side has insisted that it will not be bound by deadlines and that it's opposed to any fragile deal. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
In Britain, the first glimpse of a Partygate questionnaire confirms that Downing Street insiders are being questioned under police caution and asked if they have a reasonable excuse for attending lockdown-busting gatherings. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnist Heather Stewart. The piece is titled, "Leak Confirms Partygate Questionnaire Includes Police Caution." The first glimpse of a Partygate questionnaire confirms that Downing Street insiders are being questioned under police caution and asked if they have a reasonable excuse for attending lockdown-busting parties. Prime Minister Boris Johnson has already returned his replies to the Metropolitan Police's questions and is believed to have argued that he attended social events at No. 10 Downing Street in a work capacity. A copy of one of the official questionnaires obtained by ITV shows it includes the police caution, "You do not have to say anything, but it may harm your defence if you do not mention when questioned something which you subsequently rely on in court. Anything you do say may be given in evidence." Angela Rayner, Labour's deputy leader, said, "This is an embarrassment that for the first time in United Kingdom history, we have a Prime Minister interviewed under police caution." As well as asking the recipients to confirm their attendance at a specific event, the leaked questionnaire shows they were also asked, "What was the purpose of your participation in that gathering? And did you interact with or undertake any activity with other persons present at the gathering? If yes, please provide details." Recipients of the questionnaire were offered the opportunity to give a lawful exception or reasonable excuse for attending. Boris Johnson is understood to have hired a lawyer to help him draw up his responses, which Downing Street has confirmed were submitted before the deadline of last Friday. Questionnaires are still being sent to some officials. The Metropolitan Police will then have to decide whether to impose fixed penalty notices for breaking lockdown rules. The Metropolitan Police investigation into 12 social events, several of which the Prime Minister is known to have attended, was triggered by evidence uncovered by the senior civil servant Sue Gray, whose full report on her inquiry will not be published until the police have completed their work. Boris Johnson's allies are convinced he has a justification for attending events that took place at No. 10, which is his home as well as his workplace. He initially denied reports that parties had been held in Downing Street, telling MPs all guidance was followed completely. Receiving a fixed penalty notice for breaching rules that he himself drew up is regarded as unacceptable to many Conservative backbenchers and would be likely to prompt more letters calling for a vote of no confidence. If 54 such letters are submitted to the chair of the 1922 committee, Graham Brady, a vote of no confidence in Boris Johnson would be triggered, and if he lost such a vote, his premiership would be effectively over. Meanwhile, Prime Minister Boris Johnson has repeatedly refused to say whether he would resign if fined by the police for breaking COVID laws at a series of alleged Downing Street parties. After handing back a questionnaire to the Metropolitan Police, which is expected to defend his presence at some of the dozen events under investigation, the Prime Minister dodged a series of questions about the issue. Asked if he would quit if Scotland Yard issued him with a fixed penalty notice worth at least £100, Boris Johnson told BBC's Sunday morning programme, "I can't comment about a process that is already underway." He said he would have something meaningful to say about this, when the Metropolitan Police investigation ended, but insisted that any answers now would be interpreted as a point of commentary about the process. Boris Johnson added he hoped people won't have long, but said, "There's not a jot I can say until it's done." Previously, the Prime Minister has commented on specific events, including a bring-your-own-bottle garden party to which more than 100 Downing Street staff were invited. The gathering was held on 20th of May 2020, when only two people from different households could meet outdoors, socially distanced. Last month, Boris Johnson denied any wrongdoing and claimed technically no rules were broken and that he thought it was a work event.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, parenting pathology. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the parenting pathology and what are the things that comes under this topic. The first thing that comes under this topic is the loss of the authority of the parents in the religious training of their kids. According to the Islamic teachings, what we can see is that the parents, especially the father and mother, and the father is the authority and is the guardian of the family. Even in the non-Islamic societies, parents are the guardians of their kids. Parents are the guardians of their own children. And in Islam, it has been emphasized a lot that the father, especially, is the main guardian and the authority in the family. And in training kids, in raising kids, the main role where the mother is playing her role, the father also have a specific role where he has to train the kids, he has to brought them up according to the Islamic teachings, and it is the duty of the mother and father. But the problem occurs when this authority no more remains authority over kids, when the kids are reaching to a specific age where they are no more following the sayings or the orders of their parents. And that is the time where, obviously, most of people, they refer or they consult different scholars, whereas this should not happen if they were aware of this loss, if they were aware of such pathology, then obviously they could have done something else before this stage, inshallah. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of parenting pathology, and we said that the loss of authority of parents is one of the aspects towards which the parents do not have any attention. In the Islamic teachings, we see that Imam Ali alayhi salam has also said that the children have three rights on their father. Like, there are three things which the father should do. The first thing is to choose a good name for his children. The second thing is to train them in the best way. يُحَسِّنَ أَدَبَهُ, to teach him ethics, to teach him the best ethics and best etiquettes. And the third thing is وَيُعَلِّمَهُ الْقُرْآنَ, and to teach him Qur'an. These are the three things, the basic three things, which a father must do for his children. And this is upon the father to perform all these things. It is kind of an obligation, we can say, according to this hadith or the narration that we have. Therefore, if a father is not doing this, if he's not teaching them the good etiquettes or the good manners, ethics, even the Quran, and is not choosing a good name for them, then obviously when they're grown up, they can see that their father did not pay attention towards them. And then they can learn anything from anywhere else, which will result in not having the authority of father over the children. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/Ian Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Thank you. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Palestinians in eastern Al-Quds are structurally oppressed by the Israeli apartheid regime and subjugated to its systematic detention, arrest, dispossessions, land theft and killings. For decades, Palestinians in eastern Al-Quds have been victims of ongoing ethnic cleansing. We're prepared for you an article written by Denijol Jejic, an author and researcher from Lebanon, under the heading, The Apartheid Regime's Extrajudicial Executions of Palestinians. Muhammad Shokat Salima, a 25-year-old Palestinian, was shot at point-blank range and martyred by Israeli occupation forces in occupied eastern Al-Quds. Zionist authorities and much of Western media framed him as an attacker. However, the extrajudicial killings of Palestinians on occupied land are part and parcel of the settler colonial regime's terror against the indigenous population. A video of Muhammad Shokat Salima's assassination by Israeli occupation forces was filmed by bystanders and went viral on the internet. It shows that the young Palestinian did not pose any imminent threat to the heavily armed Israeli occupation forces. He was shot repeatedly and martyred as he lay wounded on the ground. According to the Palestinian Red Crescent Society, Israeli occupation forces denied medics access to the site, and thus, Muhammad Shokat Salima could not receive any first aid. Israeli occupation authorities justified the murder, claiming that the assassinated Palestinian had previously tried to stab an Israeli. Extrajudicial assassinations of Palestinians, including innocent children by the Israeli regime, are not isolated incidents, but part and parcel of the genocidal settler colonial terror. While the Israeli regime claims to be a democracy, Palestinians are not only subject to brutal military rule, but also excluded from the entity's so-called legal system. Palestinians are dehumanized to an extent that they can be killed in cold blood at any time. The justification for the assassination of Palestinians is always present in the Zionist narrative, as is the jailing and kidnapping of Palestinians by the apartheid regime. As part of the broader coercion strategy in the aftermath of the assassination, Israeli occupation forces terrorized residents in Salima's hometown of Salfit in the occupied West Bank, raided the home of Salima and arrested his brother. While the story seemed newsworthy, much of the mainstream Western media failed to identify the power relations, the colonial nature, and the particular illegality of Israel's actions under international law. Indeed, in much of the mainstream media, the assassination was portrayed as a reaction to the stabbing attempt and within a context of the broader violence in eastern Al-Quds. News agencies provided headlines such as Israeli wounded in eastern Al-Quds stabbing, assailant killed, or police kill Palestinian attacker after Al-Quds stabbing. Oftentimes categorizing the story under so-called Israel-Palestine conflict within Zionist terms. In an article by Al Jazeera English, based on reports from news agencies, the Palestinian victim is portrayed as an attacker stabbing Jewish man. The article states that Israeli security forces shot the Palestinian after he stabbed an Israeli civilian and tried to attack the police. The first source to be mentioned is Israel's Magen David Adom Emergency Service. Similarly, the New York Times opposed the Palestinian assailant to the Israeli civilian. This framing and the focus on religion and ethnicity makes it seem as if a dangerous Palestinian decided to kill an innocent Jewish civilian and thus had to be stopped by police officers. The incident is thus portrayed as a violent hate crime perpetrated by the Palestinian man. Yet, much of the discourse obscures the colonial context and the asymmetrical power relations. The Palestinians' actions are not the source of violence in occupied Palestine. In fact, he's a victim of the apartheid and occupying regime and has probably suffered his entire life under a brutal military occupation and the multifaceted abuses that come with it. Not only can the Zionist military forces kill Palestinians at any time, they also enjoy impunity and the apartheid regime's backing. Indeed, Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett was quick to express his support for the execution of the Palestinian and in appreciation posted a picture of the killers on social media. The Zionist leader said, "That is how our forces are expected to act and that is how they acted." Support for the assassination was echoed throughout the Zionist political spectrum. Referring to Israelis on illegally occupied lands as civilians further normalizes Israeli colonial violence. Most Israelis, regardless whether they are actively enlisted in the occupying army or not, have undergone military training and enjoy backing of the apartheid regime. For example, settler violence is a well-documented ongoing form of terrorism that is directly backed by the colonial regime apparatus. And of course, the mere presence of Israeli military forces in eastern Al-Quds is illegal in itself, given that the territory is under military occupation. Palestinians in eastern Al-Quds, where the assassination of Mohammad Shoukat Salima took place, are structurally oppressed by the Israeli apartheid regime and subjugated to its systematic detention, arrest, dispossession, land theft, and killings. For decades, Palestinians in eastern Al-Quds have been victims of ongoing ethnic cleansing. The Israeli apartheid regime has created a judicial system that allows them to steal Palestinian lands and property and dispossess them in order to make place for Jewish settlers. Any media narrative that fails to identify the colonial context in the occupied Palestine further justifies the Zionist violence.
We'll be right back.
In this settler colonial conquest of a nuclear-armed First World power against an indigenous people under military occupation, Palestinians have long been criminalized for merely surviving on their own land, and thus standing in the way of the Israeli colonizer. While their structural daily struggle is not newsworthy, their individual reactions to the Zionist terror becomes highly scrutinized in the mainstream Western media. Palestinians have the right to use all means at their disposal to resist against a foreign occupation, including armed struggle. This is even acknowledged by the United Nations, which enshrines this right in Resolution 37 and Resolution 43 from December of 1982. The brutal assassination of Mohammad Shoukat Salima became newsworthy because it was captured on camera and because the assassinated Palestinian allegedly tried to stab an Israeli. Meanwhile, Palestinians get shot and murdered by the Israeli military forces continuously off camera. A day before Mohammad Shoukat Salima was assassinated, a Palestinian was martyred by Israeli military forces in Umm al-Fahm in the occupied West Bank. A day later, a 15-year-old Palestinian teenager, Mohammad Nidal Yunus, was murdered by Israeli forces at a checkpoint near Tul Karm in the occupied West Bank. However, the Israeli attackers and assailants are not referred to as such in the dominant media discourse. The Office of the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights, OHCHR, in the occupied Palestinian territories has expressed its shock after Israeli military forces assassinated Mohammad Shoukat Salima in cold blood in eastern Al-Quds, in the old city of Al-Quds. The Office of the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights, in a statement on Sunday, 5th of December, promised to follow up on the incident and demanded that those responsible for such brutality must be brought to justice. The statement read, "Extrajudicial killings such as this are the consequence of the regular resort to lethal force by well-armed and well-protected Israeli personnel against Palestinians, and the almost total lack of accountability for killings and injuries of Palestinians by Israeli forces." The statement added, "Will there be accountability in this case?" Local sources and the Red Crescent Society said the Israeli police prevented medical personnel from providing medical care for the 23-year-old Palestinian youth. Israeli forces also attacked Palestinians nearby and fired tear gas canisters at them after shooting the young Palestinian. At least 40 people were injured by the Israeli forces at the scene. They also closed all gates of the Holy Al-Aqsa Mosque for worshippers who were heading to the Holy Mosque to perform the evening prayers. The Israeli military attacked a group of women who were heading towards the Al-Aqsa Mosque and prevented them from entering. They also launched a massive arrest campaign targeting Palestinians. The Tel Aviv regime has been criticized for its extensive use of lethal force against the extrajudicial killing of Palestinians, who do not pose an immediate threat to Israeli forces or Israeli settlers. The Palestinian Foreign Ministry has on several occasions called on the International Criminal Court at The Hague, Netherlands, to break its silence and immediately begin investigations into the crimes of the occupying regime and Israeli settlers. The United Nations Human Rights Council, in a recent annual report, voiced its deep concern at the fragmentation of the occupied Palestinian territories, including eastern Al-Quds, through illegal settlement activities and other measures. It also said it was gravely concerned that the long-standing impunity for international law violations has allowed for the recurrence of grave violations without consequence. Just listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily
from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM, 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Every night and every day, every night and every day, never forget to say, La ilaha illallah, never forget to say, La ilaha illallah.
IRIB English Radio, a heralder of unity and solidarity amongst Islamic denominations.
Oh Lord, here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure.
Hadith of the day.
Here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
You're listening to the program Hadith of the Day with Dr. Shiraz Hossein Agha on IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program Hadith of the Day here at IRIB English Radio. Thank you for joining us here. Today on Hadith of the Day, we're going to be looking at a beautiful tradition regarding the boundaries of counseling, the limitation, the jurisdiction, the rules of counseling, you might say, from Imam Sadiq. As you know, counseling is one of those things which are very important in Islam, meaning taking counsel from others, taking advice from others. This is so important that in a lot of the verses of the Holy Quran, even the Prophet has been advised to take counsel from his companions. Also, in another verse of the Holy Quran, God Almighty says, those who answer their Lord maintain the prayer, and their affairs are executed by counsel amongst themselves, and they spend out of what we have provided with them. So taking counsel from others before, you know, making a decision is one of those good virtues which God Almighty has encouraged in the Holy Quran. The question arises as to what exactly are the limitations of taking counsel from others? Who should we take counsel from, right? And then, you know, how should we go about it? In this beautiful hadith from Imam Sadiq, alayhi salam, a lot of this ambiguity has been removed and has been clarified for us. Imam Sadiq, alayhi salam, says, counsel should only be sought whilst fulfilling its four terms. What are those? Firstly, that the one whose counsel you seek must be a man of intellect, right? The person you are taking counsel and advice from should be a smart person, should be a wise person, should be an intelligent person.
But that's not enough. Secondly, that he must be a free and religious man. He should be a free and religious man. He should be religious. He shouldn't be impious. He should follow the dictates of religion. It's not enough for him to be smart, because if he's not religious, he might be smart. He might give you some advice which is contrary to religion. He might lead you astray in his advice. Maybe this is a good indication that a lot of times people, right, who live in non-Muslim countries, right, when they encounter a problem, they go straight to the psychologist. Right? It's true, the psychologist is an intelligent person. He's been trained, and he knows a lot about the human psyche. But if the person, this psychologist, is not religious, sometimes these psychologists, they give advice which is contrary to the rules of our religion, and we cannot follow them. In any case, in continuation, the Imam says, thirdly, he must be brotherly and friendly. Right? He should be a brotherly and friendly person. Right? He shouldn't be a mean person who's out to get you. And fourthly, that when you disclose your secret to him, whereby he knows as much about it as you do, he would keep your secrets and guard it well. Right? So you shouldn't go to a person who's a blabbermouth and might spill your secrets to others. These were the four pillars or limitations or boundaries of counseling in the words of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Dr. Shiraz Hossein Agha for the program Hadith of the Day on RIB English Radio.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to this edition of The Spotlight. On Thursday morning, Russian President Vladimir Putin ordered attacks on Ukraine, hitting multiple cities and bases by air, land, and sea. Russia says the attacks would only target military sites in order to stop Ukrainian aggression in the region and that Russia has no intention of occupying Ukrainian territories. Meanwhile, NATO Chief Jens Stoltenberg called the attacks, quote, a brutal act of war, while the U.S., the EU, and the U.K. have reacted by threatening to impose tough sanctions on Russia with the aim of crippling its economy. In this edition, we will be discussing the different aspects of these recent developments in Ukraine. But first, let's bring in our correspondent, Jerome Hughes, from the EU headquarters. You told us before that the EU heads of states would be meeting to discuss these developments. What updates do you have for us?
That's right. Right now, in fact, they are landing in Belgium to take part in a summit here in Brussels, which is due to begin in the next 60 minutes or so. And what the EU leaders at this summit, this face-to-face summit here in Brussels, are promising is the toughest sanctions package European Union against any country, and of course it's directed towards Russia. Tomorrow